the Brain Science Podcast, the podcast for everyone who has a brain. And I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. On the Brain Science Podcast, we explore how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mysteries of how our brains make us who we are. For more information, including show notes, links to previous episodes, and information about how to subscribe, please go to the website brainsciencepodcast.com. We also have a discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com, and you can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com.
One of the really wonderful things about the mind is it feels different. That's where this age-old, you know, mind-body thing really stems from, is that in the very big picture, we feel the mind to be separate from the rest of whatever the brain does, because that's what the brain does.
Welcome back to the Brain Science Podcast. This is episode 43. Today I have an interview with Dr. Robert Burton, author of On Being Certain. I discussed his book in episode 42, but you don't need to listen to episode 42 to enjoy this interview. I'll be back after the interview to tell you how you can find the books Dr. Burton talks about during the interview, as well as previous episodes that relate to our subject, which is the role of the unconscious in decision-making. On today's episode of the Brain Science Podcast, my guest is Dr. Robert Burton, who is the author of On Being Certain, Believing You're Right Even When You're Not. Dr. Burton is also retired from being a practicing neurologist for many years, and now he writes full-time. Bob, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Would you like to just tell my listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I graduated from Yale, and then I went to med school at UCSF and stayed there for 100 years, internship residency, and stayed on UCSF and ran the neurology department at one of its hospitals, Mount Zion. Then one day I got the writing bug and started writing some novels. The first novel came out in 91. Actually, the book that I started On Being Certain originally started as a novel, but I realized I couldn't do it in a novel form because it was more about science and philosophy. And so that's about what I do. I now write a column for Salon and enjoy thinking about thinking.
Great. I'll have to get you to give me a link to your Salon column so that I can put it into the show notes.
Okay. It's called The Mind Reader. Or called Mind Reader, actually.
Mind Reader.
It's actually about neuroscience and popular culture, so it covers a variety of subjects that are, you know, like, is the patient conscious? That type of thing.
I haven't been reading Salon recently. Do you have to pay to get to the content on Salon?
Not for the features like that, no.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure how it works. They gave me a freebie, so I can't tell, but I think you can get to all those columns.
Okay, great. So how did you come to write this book?
You know, I started this book, actually, I was going to write a novel about brain stimulation and the experiences the patients had. And at the same time, I was also collecting some notes on a variety of phenomena that I'd seen in neurology, such as Cotard syndrome, which is where a patient believes he's dead. Even when you'd show them that they have a pulse, they can't believe they're not dead. In fact, the patient that I wrote about was a patient who had encephalitis, believed she was dead. Took her pulse, showed her she had a pulse, and she said, well, this only proves that people can have a pulse. Well, I had collected a large variety of similar cases, a la Oliver Sacks, and my agent said, these are really interesting, but what's the point? So I finally spent some time thinking, well, there must be some underlying issue here, and I couldn't decide whether it be novel form, memoir form, or whatever, and I finally realized that there was an underlying question as to why all these people had the phenomenon of a belief that wasn't true, and the evidence was overwhelming that it wasn't true, and yet they maintained it. And eventually it occurred to me that the basis of this book was how we know what we know. It morphed from novel to memoir to its present form.
Did you have a particular goal in mind for what you want the book to accomplish?
No, I did this backwards, actually, because at heart I'm a novelist. So in a novel, you start a character in motion, walk him down the street, put him in a chair, and want to see what happens to him. So in this particular case, I tried to find out what these had in common. It wasn't until after I realized that the feeling of knowing was an involuntary sensation that I then went back and redid the whole thing from the point of view of how all these would fit together. Then I realized the point was that I wanted to tell people that certainty or feelings of conviction or rightness weren't within our conscious control. What didn't occur to me originally, that was the point. It only was after this was worked on for a long time that it finally dawned on me. Part of the problem was I had never heard anybody discuss mental sensations as a separate category of human experience. We don't normally think of them that way, and so I didn't have any basis. It wasn't until that occurred to me that this all fell into place.
Well, that probably is why you were able to come up with an original way of looking at this. I mean, well, the reason that I wanted to devote two episodes to your book was because I thought that the fact that the feeling of knowing is not under conscious control seems like a pretty important thing for us to become aware of.
Well, I think so. And actually, it's peculiar. I talked to a philosophy professor at Berkeley who actually had read my book, and he said, you know, we don't talk about this in philosophy. And certainly in neurology, nobody talks about these sort of neurophenomena because they're not something that you can prove. I do wish to emphasize, probably more than anything else, that I think the luxury of not being tenured at the moment, not having to do this for a career, getting an academic appointment, allows you to be wrong in thinking about something long enough that you can come up with something original. You're not forced to prove something. When you asked me how I came about this, I really didn't know what it was, nor did I feel any urgency to know what it was. And in writing a novel, you don't have to know what it is, and I'm not applying for a government grant, so I think it makes it a lot easier than when you're stuck somewhere where you have to write something and prove something.
Yeah, I had a very, very short career in medical research because I became quickly disillusioned by the fact that everybody was writing their grant proposals for what they'd actually already did.
Well, that's it. I wrote a column for Salon in which the people who I wrote about were upset. Neuroscientists will go nameless. But anyway, the guy said to me, I know this works. We just have to prove it. And I looked and said, well, that's not the way science should be done. You should say, I wonder if this works. And he said, no, I know it works. He says, so we're setting out to prove it. In fact, that's what his research ultimately represented, an effort to prove it rather than actual proof of it. It's a little editorial for the people who feel they have to prove something.
That certainly seems to influence the medical literature, especially when you add in the influence of the drug companies paying for the studies.
Yes, I'm actually doing a little piece for Salon on placebo effect this next week, and one of the questions is, what's the value of Prozac? Now, I don't know much about psychoactive drugs, but when you start to read the literature, half of the studies don't show that there's anything better than placebo. And then you realize you really have to go through each study with a fine-tooth comb, but even then, you can fiddle around with it. I did an NIH project where I don't even think we came to understanding what the disease we were looking at was straightforward and where we could study it. So.
Yeah. Let's get back to the book for a minute. To me, I came away with the feeling that, I almost feel like I'm using a pun when I say that one of the important concepts in your book was the perceptual nature of thought. Looking at thought as being similar to something like the way we look at the way we do vision.
Right.
Because we understand that optical illusions trick our visual perception, but we somehow think that our thinking should not be prone to such things.
Correct. And actually, the image that I've been working on since I wrote the book that I'm not quite clear I can articulate, but I'll give it a try, is that we all know, I think most of us accept, that the brain does everything that we experience in terms of thoughts and feelings and all the rest of it. I mean, I think that's accepted. But we don't somehow recognize that these all come out of little cells that then connect together. And they make a higher level of group. So let's say you take individual cells that will see one aspect of motion, of vision. Another will see lines, another will be borders. And they'll merge together to make an elemental image of something. And then another section will recognize color, recognize the location of where it is, that it's in flight. And then another higher level will generate an image which goes somehow into consciousness as a butterfly. But I don't think we recognize that one of the things that the brain generates is the sensation of the mind looking down at the butterfly. But it comes out of the same material. So that the mind itself is generated by the same neurons that are generating the rest of the perceptions. And all of these neurons, collectively in neural networks, are subject to all sorts of perceptual illusions. One of the really wonderful things about the mind is it feels different. That's where this age-old, you know, mind-body thing really stems from, is that in the very big picture, we feel the mind to be separate from the rest of whatever the brain does because that's what the brain does.
Yeah.
It's a perceptual illusion at the very core. So all these debates about mind-body really are just a misunderstanding of how the brain works.
Didn't you say something about our mental limitations make it impossible for us to accept our mental limitations?
Right. And really part of this is, if really what you experience in the mind are all the sensations associated with the mind, like I'm thinking or I'm contemplating whatever, the limitation is I'm thinking, and therefore, if I'm not thinking, I must not be thinking. We use the sensation to determine what our brain is doing, but we can't see our brain in the unconscious. So the limitation we really have is that we can only see what our brain tells us we can see, and what our brain tells us to do about what we see. It's the one that says to you, oh, I'm thinking about this. All these questions like free will and stuff really get down to what you experience at a conscious level versus what you're actually doing.
One of the things that relates to that is when the ideas seem to come out of nowhere because we don't have access to where the thoughts came from before they reached our conscious awareness, and we get all kinds of distortions about when this happens. Would you like to talk a little bit about, because I don't think I covered this well enough in my review of your book, a little bit about how our brain distorts our perception of when things happen?
Sure. The example I use in the book is pretty straightforward. Imagine that you go to your friend Joe Blow's house 20 years ago, and you sit in his living room, he's there, and you make a very strong mental association that he lives on Filbert Street, let's say. And you recognize the front porch and the house and so on. And that's how you learn what his house is. His house is not only a visual image, but it's now embedded with a sensation, yes, that is his house, because that's the only way you would learn it. So that feeling of knowing that we talked about really is about the likelihood of correctness of the visual image he sees. Now, so you see this house 20 years ago, and now 20 years later he invites you over, and you're driving down the street. The only way that you could possibly recognize his house is to already know that it's his house. But it wouldn't make sense to look out and feel, ah, that's his house, until after you had seen it. So the way your mind experiences is, let's see, I'll drive down here. There's a red house, a white house, blue house. Oh, there's the house with the porch. That must be Joe's house. But no, the fact that you knew it was Joe's house made you recognize it in the first place. So you knew in advance, but felt the sensation occurring after the fact. And so this rearrangement of time is essential for learning something and then being able to recognize anything. So virtually everything that we see, like if I recognized you in the street, I would have first recognized you as my calculation would be, that's a very high likelihood it's Ginger Campbell. And then I would say, oh, that's Ginger. But then it would have felt like the calculation occurred after the fact. And this is what I was really referring to. We don't know when thoughts begin. I don't even know how this book that I wrote began, but I do know one thing, that after my mom passed away, I found a paper in her collection of stuff that she'd left for me that was a paper I'd written on the same subject 40 years ago, which I had forgotten. I had forgotten absolutely and completely. It never occurred to me. It was a college paper I wrote when I was 17 or something. Obviously, it's been percolating along in the unconscious somehow until it emerged. You asked me when I started this book, I could tell you the time that I experienced beginning it, but I couldn't tell you when it actually began, because we really have no access to when our thoughts begin in the unconscious.
Yeah, I like the fact that in your book you pointed out that when, and since you're a novelist, I think that you have the right to say this, that when you have an idea that you aren't consciously thinking about, and let's say a problem in your novel or whatever, and the solution comes to you, that it seems common for people to attribute that to some kind of mystical source instead of the fact that it actually came from their own brain.
Correct. And, you know, it's interesting. I wrote one novel where I could not think of the ending. And really, it went on for like 5 months. Nothing worked. And one night, I remember someone was telling me about a friend of hers had a cardiac arrest in Bangkok and then awakened. And I remember thinking about it and going to bed. And in the middle of the night, I awakened and the whole thing appeared all at once, the whole last chapter. I jumped up, wrote it down, and it stayed verbatim, except for, you know, the usual editing. I thought, wow, how did that happen? So you were thinking, how did that happen? Well, the fact of the matter is your unconscious had all the pieces in place, but because it didn't have a sense that it was right, it didn't send it into consciousness, the idea for an ending, until it got the missing piece. So the missing piece provoked it, but it was all primed and ready to go, which is a fascinating idea. It wasn't some muse or some extraterrestrial being sent in information to me. It was just the missing piece for my unconscious, but I didn't know that.
I don't want to get into this right now, but don't let me forget at the end, we need to come back to the implications of this for approaches of like the psychologist and psychotherapist, because they seem to give the unconscious all these kinds of pseudoscientific magical abilities.
Right, exactly.
But before we get on to that, I wanted to ask you about how all this ties into the reward systems of the brain. What do you think the key idea is about how this feeling of knowing relates to the reward system of the brain?
Well, you know, it took me a long time. I sort of went through a series of thought experiments to try and figure this out. One of the questions is, why would you pursue a thought for which you had no idea it was correct? In other words, if you envision the unconscious as generating virtually an infinitude of ideas, experience, some of which will rise into consciousness, many of which will go by the boards, question me, why does something arise into consciousness, and then you say, I'm going to think about that? Well, there would have to be some unconscious mechanism generate some idea of the likelihood that this was something worth pursuing, whether it's aesthetic or going to lead to a scientific discovery or it's going to make you money or whatever it is. There would have to be some reward for an unconscious thought. And I thought, well, what would it be? Well, it would have to be some sense that if you pursue this, something good will come out of it. So there has to be a good feeling or sense of motivation. Otherwise, every single thought that your unconscious mind had would appear in consciousness. And I thought, well, okay, there's got to be some feeling or some quality that arises that makes some thoughts preferable to others prior to you knowing they're any good. And I said, so it's got to be something that feels good about the thought. I think probably a good example is the hunch. You wake up in the morning and go, I got a great idea. Now, what you really have is a feeling that you got a great idea along with the idea. You have no idea if it's a good idea. Well, you really do need a reward system for thinking, and it's probably got to be as powerful as for everything else. If you don't have it, you won't do anything. When you see a kid who's stuck in high school algebra or Latin or whatever it is, and he goes, I don't know why I have to do this. You can't get him to do it until somehow he understands that maybe he's going to get into college with it or whatever it is. But if he doesn't understand, he won't do it. Most thoughts, we have to feel they're worthwhile. So the reward system has to be really primed. I think now the evidence is that the connections between the limbic system and the midbrain, you know, mesolimbic reward systems are really quite powerful. And I think that you can't think of a thought without a reward.
You also brought out the idea that maybe some people might actually be addicted to feeling that they're right all the time.
Well, you know, I try to strike a middle ground in genetics because I don't think genes control everything. They obviously have a significant influence how you think. I'm on the far end of the skeptical. I just don't get that feeling of knowing very often. So when I see something, I always think, I wonder if the other would be true. I wonder if the opposite's true, da-da-da-da. Other people, on the other hand, I suspect have a very strong sense of it. I'm sure you know the people that are always right. They cannot be wrong. And they seem to have a great joy out of being right. And I wouldn't be surprised if it is a form of an addiction.
Well, most of us are kind of in the middle. Do you think that we can learn to be more comfortable with uncertainty, since the reality is most of the time we have to make a lot of decisions without being really sure?
Well, I guess that also gets down to the pleasure. This gets back to your reward thing. I actually enjoy being uncertain, and I enjoy the idea of ambiguity. In other words, it's probably one of the reasons that I like writing novels is I like the idea that there can be multiple solutions, not even a solution, but multiple endings. There can be multiple things a character can do. All that would be within character. I've never really enjoyed starting with the premise, I am going to prove this. I remember sitting down with one of the really famous best-selling mystery writers, and he said to me, I always write the ending first because I want to know where I'm going. And I said, dude, if I knew where I was going, I wouldn't start the book.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, so these are different, but I do believe there are actually different ways of thinking about the world that come out of your biology. I just like the idea that this could be wrong. When you say to me, can you teach people, I don't know that you can teach people who love to be right not to be right, because I think in part you have to start really young where they train to understand that this isn't necessarily true. It might be an illusion, the idea that you're correct. But once the circuitry is really in there, it's like having a bad backhand in tennis or something. It's really hard to get rid of.
I know in medicine, it seems like people in different specialties have different personalities. As I'm an emergency room doctor, and we're always having to act with incomplete information. And then the radiologists drive us bonkers, you know, because they're always sending us reports that say, well, it might be this or it might be that. Order another test, which does us no good.
It's interesting. I started in neurology in part because they didn't have any tests. That was when I started my residency. They didn't have CAT scans and MRIs or anything.
It was all physical exam.
And history. It was fun to speculate. It was also fun to know there was lots of leeway for error. You knew you were going to be wrong a fair percentage of the time because you had no way to confirm your ideas. So you attracted the people who were sort of like gentleman philosopher doctors. Now with the genetic code, et cetera, all the molecular biology, you're attracting a different breed of person. So I really do think you select out not only your field you go into, but, you know, what branch of medicine is in part dictated by how you feel about not enjoying being wrong or not having to be correct. So you're right about the radiologist. No comment.
Do you want to say anything else about where genetics comes in? I agree with you that we can't really ever explain something as complex as behavior purely with genetics. But when it comes to this feeling of knowing, do you think there's anything else we need to say about that?
Well, I think there's one thing is that when you start a thought, you feel as though it starts from its origination. For example, I think George Bush said last week he was going to want to do more oil drilling. Okay? So I think we think, I'm going to sit down and think about oil drilling, the pros and cons. It feels on a conscious basis that our thought is going to be a rational exploration of oil, for oil. Okay? But try a simple experiment. If I say to you, Exxon Valdez, what's the first image you get?
Oil spill.
Right. Now, someone else might get long gas lines.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, in that image that you got, see, when you ask people, you divide them up right away. I have a family member who says long gas line because he doesn't have the same starting point for the thoughts that then generate his thinking about oil drilling. And I think in part it depends upon how your memory is stored. So as you mentioned on the podcast, there's evidence now that whether or not you store fearful memories is in part related to a single gene, in mice at least. In the mice, you knock out that gene, they don't have that fearful memory. Well, they're not going to be afraid of an oil spill if they were a politician, let's say. So they're going to start with a different additional reference point that you don't have, which is, there is no such thing as fear about this. We can fix it up. Technology comes up with all these ideas. So I think that though genes don't influence the behavior, they influence your thoughts that lead to your behavior in ways that we can't really understand. So if somebody was fearful about an oil spill, talking to someone who wasn't, that's not a level playing field. They can't talk to each other where their ideas will start at the beginning, so their lines of reasoning are different. And I think genes have an enormous amount to do with that. I mean, all these identical twin studies and so on suggest that our preferences, in large part, are dictated by genetic biases.
I want to talk some more about the whole, what did you call it, the myth of the autonomous logical mind?
Rational mind, yeah, rational mind.
Rational mind. I want to talk about that in a minute, but we talked about thought as being a perceptual thing, and you also talk quite a bit in the book about thought as a sensation. And those seem to be like overlapping ideas, but what does it mean to look at thought as a sensation?
I don't know if thought is a sensation in the, but the feeling about a thought has to be. In other words, I used the example in the book, which sounded intentional. It was intentional part. When I was finishing up the book, I was in bed with my wife, and I said to her, what was the name of that cartoon figure that was the possum that was all philosophical? She said, I can't remember. And I said, watch this. I am going to do an experiment on my mind in which I'm going to intentionally ask my unconscious, who wrote the comic strip? What was the name of the comic strip?
Mm-hmm.
And I went to bed. And when I woke up in the morning, sure enough, it was Walt Kelly and Pogo. It came right up, and I said, whoa, see, it did work just like that. Now, the thing about it is, I could not feel my mind thinking, but it obviously was thinking how to come up with the name. The only way I was aware of the answer was I was aware that suddenly the answer appeared in my mind, but I was never aware of thinking of it. So now you say, well, then what's the difference between that kind of thought and a thought that you're doing consciously? Well, one aspect which is certain is that you feel like you're thinking. And I've never heard it described, but the only way you know you're thinking consciously versus unconsciously is the sensation of the thought. So when I say the thought is a sensation, at least in part, conscious thought has to be a sensory awareness of what the brain is doing, as opposed to just what the brain is doing. Because if it was just what the brain was doing, you would be aware of all the information for Pogo. I never got all the names of the various cartoon characters that it went through to find that name. So it has to have a sensation for us to know we're doing it. I think this is another thing that's been sorely overlooked, is the brain has ways to notify itself of what it's doing. So it's up to the unconscious to tell you when you're thinking.
Just like we're not aware of all the stuff that goes on before what we consciously see reaches our awareness, all that processing, we don't see that either.
That's exactly correct. You know, there was a study that just came out a few weeks ago, which I'm still trying to sort through, was where they did these fMRI studies, and they asked people to press a button with either their left hand or their right hand while they were in a scanner, you know, make an arbitrary choice. And it turned out that at least 5 seconds before they made any conscious choice, appropriate area of the brain lit up on fMRI scan, and this is the whole argument, who chose what? In other words, from a conscious perspective, it was chosen unconsciously, and then unconsciously, and then came into conscious. But from a conscious perspective, you feel like you chose it sometime later. This gets back to that same thing about perception of time. If you look at it that way, these are sensory phenomena within the brain that dictate how we feel about our thoughts and actually guide them. That makes sense?
Yeah. One of the subjects that's been going on my discussion forum has been how this relates to the idea of free will. And one person wrote, well, if it was in my unconscious, it was still me.
That's right. And actually, that's one of the major questions is most of us only think of our conscious as being our self, so to speak. And then this whole diminished capacity argument about, well, he couldn't help himself because his unconscious told him to do it. I think the idea of what is you is an outdated term based upon the idea that we are conscious, rational human beings. Once you realize that a lot of what we do is unconscious, then free will or decision making. If you step back from free will and just change the word to choice, well, the unconscious has all kinds of choices because it's making them all the time. Free will implies that it's free of material influence, which is probably a non-sequitur, probably is meaningless.
Yeah.
Your brain is materialistic at some level, and yet you do have choices. I had a choice not to do this interview, you do this interview. So yes, we do have free will, but it's of a different sort. It's more of a choice. Ben Libet, I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yes, yes.
He and I shared an office. We're next door in the Neuroscience Institute at Mount Sinai. And he said, you know, your unconscious makes lots of decisions, but your conscious still retains the veto power.
Right.
And I think that's a profound comment because really what he's saying is, yes, maybe your idea will appear to you from out of the unconscious, but you can then contemplate it, and then you can input back into your unconscious your thoughts about it and change the way you think about things, the feedback loop from the conscious to the unconscious.
Which I think means that in the end, we have responsibility for the choices that we do make.
Correct. I totally agree. And it's not an all or nothing. It's an intermediate ground. We have choices within the limits of our biology.
Right. Now, one of the ideas that you talked about in your book that I think, although it wasn't a theme, is an important one to remind people about. You talk a little bit about the idea of cognitive dissonance.
Right. Cognitive dissonance, obviously everybody understands it in the psychological terms of, oh, how could he believe that all the evidence is to the contrary? If you take somebody, for example, who I don't mean to be religious, but someone who believes physically in the resurrection, he has to know at some level that this isn't physiologically possible as we understand biology. And yet it has great meaning for him in terms of his iconography for religion. Well, under these circumstances, it would seem good up till recently to make some sort of psychological discussion of why he might feel that way. Maybe he wants to be religious. Maybe he's got deep-seated needs, da-da-da. But the fact of the matter is, it seems to be manifest by a belief system, namely the feeling of knowing that's so strong that even when you know the physiology doesn't make sense, that feeling the physiology doesn't make sense is not as strong as the feeling that, yes, this occurred. You know, there are lots of people who just simply cannot accept life, whether it's flying saucers or UFOs or alien abductions. There are lots of so-called cognitive dissonance, which actually, I think, emanates from an overpowering feeling of knowing on a physiologic basis as to why that occurs. Maybe in part it is psychological, maybe in part it's because of people's predisposition to the ease with which they can experience this feeling. I actually don't know why some people are more prone to it than others, but it ends up being a physiological phenomenon at the root of cognitive dissonance, namely an inappropriate feeling of knowing, making a wrong idea seem more correct than evidence to the contrary.
And one of the questions that one of my listeners submitted was, one of the things you said several times in the book was that in general, the feeling of knowing tends to overrule the logical or the evidence for most people, even when they're confronted with the facts. And one of my listeners wanted me to ask you, why does the feeling win out?
Because I think at the heart of it all, we are emotional beings. Just take falling in love. You've never heard of anybody who was dissuaded from attaching themselves to somebody where from an outside observer's point, you see it's a horrible match because of any kind of logic. They may even agree to you, but the emotion of love is too overpowers whatever comes second. I guess it has very strong evolutionary roots. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's got to do with procreation or whatever, but love is clearly outdistance anything that comes second, such as reason, right? By the same token, if you didn't have a feeling of knowing, there'd be no reason to do anything. You would be totally lost. The feeling of knowing is a very powerful, without it, you would have no learning. In other words, the only way you can really learn is by 2 + 2 = 4, isn't that right? And the teacher says, yes, that's right, Johnny, you did fine. And eventually you feel really good about 2 + 2 = 4 and you learn that. Well, if you didn't have that feeling, you'd learn nothing. So I think that this feeling of knowing must be enormously powerful and must subvert reason when the two come into conflict. One is more biologically necessary. I think reason came much later and is much less of an evolutionary necessity than this feeling of correctness, which is at the heart of learning, is at the heart of what causes reasoning in the first place. In other words, reasoning is dependent upon the feeling. The feeling isn't dependent upon the reason.
kind of brings us way back to what David Hume wrote. I think that's what he argued, was that the mind was really the stepchild of our emotions.
Correct. That is correct. I mean, really, if you think about this, you wouldn't have reason without that feeling, because you know, you'd never be able to go, well, I think that's right.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you could certainly have the feeling without the reason. That's what the aha is. That's sort of the aha, that life is wonderful. You don't need the reason for that.
I really appreciated the fact that you, on several occasions in your book, argued for more tolerance from both ends, from believers and non-believers, toward each other's stances on these things, since we really don't have a conscious control over when we have that feeling, or just like you said, you're more on the skeptical end. That's not something you can will.
No, it really isn't, and it's just the way I am. And, you know, I got an email the other day from a prominent trial attorney in America who said he's writing a book for lawyers. And after reading the book, he's writing a chapter on how, in looking out at the opposing lawyer and at the jury and the judge, you should say, well, if each of these people has independent lines of reasoning arising out of dissimilar unconscious mechanisms, such as the hidden layer we talked about, then I have to look upon them with more respect, and that they aren't just dodos that disagree with me. And I thought this was really interesting, because then I suddenly saw a jury box as 12 different hidden layers, as opposed to a group of people that you had to convince that you were right.
That's a great example. You had a chapter where you talked about gut feelings and intuition, and you particularly talked about the book Blink, which I bring it up because it's a book I have talked about in the past. Do you want to say anything about that before I comment?
Well, you know, I don't mean to do character assassination, because Gladwell is a great writer. I mean, he is really a sensationally good New Yorker-style writer, and I admire him greatly. But I think in this particular case, he's made not only a faulty assumption, but one which is really dangerous. If you have a second, what basically he did is he says that he wrote his book based in part upon reading this book by Timothy Wilson, Strangers to Ourself, about the inacceptability of unconscious thought. But Gladwell thought was, well, maybe there are ways that you can train this in some way. So he uses examples of where unconscious thought turns out to be as right, as he calls it, as more deliberate thought. But the fact of the matter is, all thought originates in the unconscious. It is then modified, edited, scrutinized, examined, and tested in the conscious. So the idea that the unconscious is suddenly a spring or a marvelous fountain of ideas is a truism. It is of no meaning, because that's where thoughts originate. The question is, can you know if these thoughts are correct? And he uses an example in the start of his book, if you remember, about the Greek statue.
Yeah.
And the Greek Koros, which is a 500 BC statue, was bought for $10 million, and the people at the museum thought it was great, and then some people came along and said that they were revulsed by the sight of it. It was a forgery or phony. So Gladwell says it turns out that these people, and he uses the word absolutely right, that's the quote, that by their revulsion they were able to tell that this was a forgery. No, these people were experts, like from the museum. They were experts who had expertise as part of the unconscious. You learn something, you do it over and over again, and it becomes part of your unconscious. So on an expert level, they made an unconscious decision that they thought was right. Well, the answer is, they made an expert decision, and it could have been right. But it's up to the conscious mind to test it out, to use some sort of empirical method to see whether this really was a forgery. So the fact is that they went out and did all these studies. They still don't know. I looked this up a few weeks ago in the catalog from the Getty Museum, and they listed as either a 550 BC statue or a forgery. And he says, but perhaps that's because we don't understand the methods of Greek burial statues. So when Gladwell says they were absolutely right, he's absolutely wrong. In doing it, he's glorifying or deifying the unconscious as having the ability to know when it's correct. And this is why I divided my book into two things. Those things which you should be opinioned. The unconscious came up with an opinion, but it didn't come up with scientific evidence. And it's up to the conscious person to test the statue whatever way he can, you know, carbon dating, whatever, to see if they can justify the opinion. So he can't know that this was absolutely right. And then for him to say that is the same reason that doctors say, I have a gut feeling that you got this or that or the other thing. No, no, that's not the correct way of thinking. So I take great exception with his book on that basis.
The question that came to my mind as I read what you were writing was, he doesn't seem to really make a distinction between the expert knowledge that, say, a physician has acquired and has kind of become part of our unconscious circuitry in some ways, so that we don't have to think about it every time we see a patient, and stuff that comes out of your unconscious that's really not based on anything like that.
That's correct. Take a surgeon, for example, or take yourself in an emergency room situation. So you have a feeling, oh, this is nothing. Oh, this is a person who may have appendicitis. And you make some qualitative judgment. Okay, so your experience that you have over a bunch of years goes and becomes part of the unconscious mental processing. It becomes additional information. It feels as though it's better. And so for some medical experience, it clearly is better. Obviously, the real criterion would be, okay, let's do a study on ER docs and see whether or not they're better than chance alone diagnosing appendicitis based upon the clinical experience. And if they are, then you've shown that statistically that your expertise is of value. In this case, you can find out because you can see whether or not the people have appendicitis. You can do CT scans or whatever, right? So you can know. You can judge where expertise works. But in other cases, you can't know where the expertise works. There's no, if they don't know whether or not this statute is a forgery, then you're still left with the expertise being untested. You're absolutely right. Expertise goes to inform your unconscious. And obviously, it's a major portion of how you think is expertise. And then you just test it if you can. If you can't, you say, in my opinion, you got appendicitis. That's fine. But there are differences between just any old random idea and expertise.
So I think that one of the key things you were trying to bring out in that chapter was that we can't know when the feeling of knowing is right. We can't stop there.
Right. And really, I think it's pretty simple to say, okay, is this an idea that I can test, or is this an idea that I have to carry with me as feeling right, but I can't know that it's right? And that really, it does separate out the sort of scientific questions from the metaphysical or the political or practical. I mean, you can't know whether it's better to go to the beach or the mountains for a vacation. One feels better than another, but that's not really the kind of opinion that you can test. You just have to know that. But I mean, when people say we should be in Iraq or we should be out of Iraq or we should do oil drilling, I mean, they act as though these are things that can be tested. Those aren't testable ideas.
Right. Another thing you said in the book was that the feeling afterwards that you're happy with the choice you made is not a valid criteria for deciding it was the right choice.
Oh, well, I mean, that study I mentioned in the book about, the interesting thing is since I wrote it, it's become even more popular because there are more books on gut feeling, is the idea that if you ask people to make a decision where they want to live, and they'll tell you that if they use their unconscious split-second or distracted opinion rather than when they're concentrating on it, they make a better choice, the choice that they're happier with. But if your choice is to buy a home in Malibu and it feels great, and then it slides into the ocean, it wasn't a good choice. And so the real question would have been, in that case, this guy in studying good choice versus bad choices, what would have been a reasonable criterion? I don't know what it would have been, but certainly not the fact you think it feels like a good choice. Saying a choice is good because it feels like a good choice is just a circular argument.
And it brings us back to the whole idea of tolerance, since, as you pointed out, there's an awful lot of things that we can never really know.
Yes.
Stuff that people really care a lot about.
One of the things that writing this book over took so long to write is I now don't know that I'm tolerant, more tolerant, but I do recognize that their opinions are arising out of a separate process from mine and that I can't know which one's correct. It should make me more tolerant. I hope it does. I'm aware of the fact that they're not starting from the same position. Just that alone is helpful.
And I'd like to return to the myth of the autonomous rational mind, because the whole fact that this is not really under our conscious control has some big implications, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Just being aware of the fact that we are a complex organism which developed an additional faculty, which is awareness of what the unconscious is doing, doesn't make you rational. And it does mean that you have to have empathy for our biology. In other words, you take Richard Dawkins, he says something about faith as a cop-out. Now, I am 100% in favor of Dawkins' ideas on evolutional investment, but he has to also understand that our biology is more, it's sort of like telling someone in love, don't be in love. Well, that doesn't make sense. Don't have faith. A lot of this is sort of us all pursuing our biology to greater or lesser degrees as best we can. We have to sort of develop a society which is more consistent with our biologic principles rather than having some enlightenment sense that there's a rational mind and that should govern the way we are. It reminds me of Nancy Reagan saying, just say no to drugs or, you know, or whatever. I mean, that may be true. I mean, it sounds great. I have no objection to that, except it just doesn't work. I mean, it's foolish to develop a policy like that because it goes against your biology.
I've just about gone through the questions that I had written down. And is there anything that you think I know you said in your email that I hadn't left anything out, but surely there's something that you would like to Well, what about your new ideas? You said you had some...
Well, I'm actually working on it. Is one of the questions, and I don't know if I can articulate this because it's still sort of seeping around in there, is that most of us feel that we are what our conscious mind tells us we are. That question you asked about the free will and about someone said, well, your unconscious is doing it. Isn't that part of you? I think that we sense only what we sense. We sense ourselves as darting an idea, having a thought, making plans, et cetera, et cetera. And we really don't see that that facility arises out of the same cognitive stew that causes all these perceptual illusions in general. And somehow, if you were to take a look at sort of Western thought, it really is all about the mind-body thing. All the major questions arise out of the conception that the mind is somehow a separate entity. I mean, there's a book by John Searle, the philosopher. He has a whole book called The Mind, and he covers all the various kinds of theories of. But none of them make any sense if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because way down deep, the mind is simply a higher level function that we can't conceptualize. Just the same way as you said, it's more than the sum of its parts, I think you said in a podcast. This whole idea of emergence is really impossible to visually see. In other words, you realize that if you take a chocolate chip and you take a piece of flour and you take water, there is no embedded cake in there. There is nothing. They're just chocolate and flour. But we know that you can make a cake. Well, the cake is material. You can still see it. But in this case, the problem is what the brain generates is something that's immaterial that we can't see, yet does exist. I mean, it exists in the same way that pain exists. Pain isn't anywhere. I mean, the brain doesn't experience pain, and the neurons aren't suffering. When you stub your toe, there's no neuron that goes, ouch. It occurs at a higher level. The problem I haven't figured out yet, which I think might be the next project, is there needs to be a metaphor for understanding higher level function when seen from a lower level that will allow people to get rid of this distinction and arguments about the mind and free will and causation. I think these are all problems of language that arise out of misconception of what the mind is, which is sort of what I think might be the next project.
Because you pointed out in your book that we don't think pain is something mystical or magical just because it can't be localized, it's emergent, yet somehow it seems natural to look at our mind and feel that it has to be somehow different.
Right, and I haven't been able to think of it because I'm too dense, but there must be some analogy or metaphoric analogy where you can say, well, just as pain exists but is undetectable, the mind exists. But it exists arising out of stuff that we cannot control. So even though it feels like it's separate, and also feels like it's in control in some sense, and also feels like it's you, and it feels like it's self, these are all phenomena that are undetectable but necessary. And I don't like to use the word illusion. Illusion implies it doesn't exist. On the other hand, it is an illusion. If you mean by illusion, you can't see it, taste it, smell it, or touch it. It's an illusion without being an illusion.
It's an illusion in the sense that it's not exactly what we think it is.
Right. And I think the problem is that most of us feel very, very strongly that we exist as people, you know, as individual persons. And if you didn't have that feeling, you wouldn't do anything. There would be no motivation. Without a sense of self, there'd be nothing what we refer to as life. And yet we must recognize that this exists somehow in a different realm. And I don't know what the word realm is. I use the word hierarchy in the book to go up to the level of consciousness. I never actually discussed my mind in that sense because I don't quite figure, but I don't believe that the philosophy that we've used has gotten us anywhere. Also, these questions about free will and responsibility and diminished capacity. For example, if you are Robert Alton Harris, he's the guy that was the murderer, I think, and then after he killed these people, he ate their hamburgers, and you know he was sentenced to an electric chair and whatever. And the argument was diminished capacity because he had childhood abuse and this, that, and the other thing, all of which was true. And he had brain damage. And the real question is, who is Robert Alton Harris? Is he just a conscious person, or does he represent all of the biology and abuse? Of course, he represents all of the above. So the question is, we need a new way of thinking about what is a person in order to attribute responsibility. If somebody has got disinterest in, let's say, reading because they read slowly, we don't punish them if we say they have dyslexia. On the other hand, is it right to say don't try? Well, we need to know what the whole person is. I suppose as we go along, we need a new, whole new conception of what the mind is. So that's my new meta project.
I heard Michael Gazzaniga interviewed on All in the Mind in relationship to this, and he made a good point that when it comes to these kinds of social things, it's also about the interrelationship with the person and his society. In other words, the person also knows that in the society he lives in, it's not okay to eat other people. He thinks that should be part of the equation when we're deciding about people's responsibility for the things that they choose to do.
Well, this actually is, there's a David Bohm, B-O-H-M.
Mm-hmm.
I had the good fortune of meeting him when I was young. I spent a weekend with him. He was a physicist who worked with Einstein. And he wrote a book called Thought as a System. And I remember spending a weekend with him. He was trying to explain what he thought the idea of the mind was. He had the idea that it was at a different order or a different level. And in other words, an emergent level. And he's tried a metaphor, which I couldn't quite grasp. But he made the point that even our thoughts aren't just ours. In other words, if you watch a bunch of skinny little models and you believe that the norm, you will inject into your unconscious hidden layer an idea of what the norm for seeing your own body is. So when you look in the mirror and you see that you're overweight, let's say in a case of anorexia, you will actually see a skinny person, I mean a fat person, when you're in fact skinny. Your perception actually came out of a social idea which became your thought. So David Bohm actually believes that you don't own your thoughts. They're part of a larger community, which I think is also a fascinating idea.
That's somewhat similar to what Gonzaga said. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we close?
No, I very much enjoyed chatting with you. I think I was also thrilled that you took the time to read my book in the way you did. I think it was fun to listen to it. I actually was listening to it. I said, gee, that sounds like an interesting book.
Well, you know, the thing about editing is that by the time I get done, I can't tell anymore because you probably experience it when you're editing your book. It's like,
oh, sure.
You can't tell if it's good anymore because you're so sick of it.
Right. Oh, but I thought I was very impressed. And I actually, you know, the funny thing is because it's hard to keep this all in mind at once, even though I've written this book and spent a lot of time on it, it always strikes me as new every time I hear it. It's counterintuitive at some level. It makes you go, that's interesting. It's hard to avoid the fact because your mind reverts back to the default position that this isn't true.
I want to thank Dr. Burton for being on the Brain Science Podcast, and I really want to encourage everyone to go ahead and read his book on being certain, believing you're right even when you're not. I think that between episode 42 and episode 43, I have covered some of the key ideas, but I think that this is a very important topic, which is why I think that if you can, you should read the book for yourself. One subject that I mentioned early on that we forgot to come back to was what are the implications for psychology and psychiatry to the fact that the unconscious really isn't totally accessible, controllable, or necessarily reliable? Because obviously there are schools of psychoanalysis that depend on the belief that our unconscious contains truths that are not in our conscious mind. Dr. Burton really doesn't talk about this in his book. He is very conscientious about staying in his own areas of expertise, and he never claims to have any expertise in psychiatry. After all, he was a neurologist. But I think if you're familiar with some of the ideas of psychology, you will see the implications of this information. The key idea, I think, is that Dr. Burton points out that our feeling of certainty about anything that comes out of our unconscious mind is not the most reliable indicator. And then there's the fact that research in memory is showing that memory is highly dynamic and that it's really easy to create false memories. That, too, has big implications for approaches of psychology that are based on uncovering a person's repressed memories about their past. Just like Dr. Burton, I can't claim to be qualified to draw final conclusions about the implications of this information, but it seems to me that at the very least, we should take the approach that information that comes from the unconscious in any sort of psychoanalysis should be put to the test. It shouldn't be assumed to be true. And if it strongly conflicts with objective evidence to the contrary, the unconscious contents shouldn't be, as Dr. Burton called it, deified. For people who do work in the field of psychology, I think this demonstrates the importance of being aware of modern neuroscience and what it's uncovering, and being willing to give up models of the mind that are not supported by the evidence. Perhaps we'll get a chance to come back to this subject from that point of view sometime in the future. Now, for just a few closing remarks. I mentioned that I would tell you about where you could find more information. For every episode of the Brain Science Podcast, I put show notes at brainsciencepodcast.com. I put quite a bit of time into these show notes, so I want to remind you that that's the place to go to find links to references from the episode, references to scientists, ideas, books, and in the case of this episode, I will have links back to several previous episodes that relate to this whole issue of unconscious decision making. As far as feedback goes, as always, I would love to hear from you. You can write to me at docartemis@gmail.com or participate in the discussion forum at brainscienceforum.com. Thanks again for listening. The Brain Science Podcast is copyright 2008 Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com.